Welcome to What CEOs Talk About. Do you wonder what CEOs talk about behind closed doors? How they bring their vision to reality? How do they overcome and succeed through adversity? We share that and so much more with each episode. Now, let's get started with the show.
Hello, everybody. My name is Martin Hunter, and I am the host of What CEOs Talk About. Today, we are going to translate something very obscure and something very specific. My guest on the show today, Lindsay, can you... Well, first of all, thank you very much for being on the show.
It is my pleasure. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Name, rank, serial number. Who are you? What do you do for a living?
Lindsay Recknell, I am a workplace mental health consultant helping organizations open the door to conversations about mental health at work.
I need mental health support. That's for sure. After what I just... Lindsay and I... So for those people listening, Lindsay and I tried to record last time and something horrific happened to my brother. So today we repost it and then we reschedule it, I should say. And then Lindsay and I are supposed to, and I'm out visiting sites and somebody fell off a ladder, broke their wrist, and I was 10 minutes late for the show. So... whoever you're out there that's trying to stop Lindsay and I from having a conversation, fooey on you. All right. For those who have asked a million times, go on whatceostalkabout.com, click on books, click on resources, click on, you'll see Lindsay's at the end of the show when the show will be posted. You'll see that you'll have her links, you'll have her, all of her work, her services are all attached there. There's also a tab called resources for the tools that are like monday.com, Bamboo HR, Lucid Chart, Slack, all of those things, all the tools that we use and that we talk about on the show for businesses are in there as well. So fill your boots, enjoy the website, and you'll see they're all divided and point up in different areas. So with that said, thank you very much. All right. Lindsay, what is the title of the show? What did you choose?
The title of the show I chose is The Science of Hope.
Hope is not a strategy.
Hope is a strategy, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, fabulous. I love that. There's going to be a challenging conversation.
Oh, heck yes.
All right. Lindsay, where do you come from? Where were you born? How were you raised? So it gives context to the audience of who, what type of person you are.
You bet. So I am a born and raised Calgarian, and there are not very many of us. Most people in Calgary these days seem to be imports, which is awesome. But I am a third generation Calgarian, which I really love because it means I have a very solid sense of place. My family is now in BC, and I've spent a number of years there back and forth over my 43 years of life. But we love to be here in Calgary. My husband's from Saskatoon and Montana, and we are right in the middle. We're close enough for our family to visit, but nobody can drop by for coffee. Go team. And it's been very cool being in this city, as watching it grow and evolve over the mm-hmm. last, you know, 20 years as an adult, which I've really appreciated as well.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more. How did you start your career? What did you go to school for? Do you have a lot of siblings? Did they punch you? Did you punch them?
So I am the oldest of three. And if you're a fan of birth order science or any of that kind of thing, it is absolutely true in my family. I was the type A personality, triple A personality, if you will, who never did anything wrong, always met curfew, you know, star student, all of the things. My middle sister rebelled against all the things. And my youngest sister is still the baby of the family. And we still make her carry the shopping bags, even though she's almost 40, but here we are. I was raised by two fabulous parents who are coming up on 50 years of marriage next summer. Wow. And feel very, very blessed to have grown up in the family that I did. We're still super close. The five of us are still ridiculously close. My sisters are both married with their own kids, and myself and my husband, like the the 12 of us are all very, very close. It's very, it's, I feel really, really lucky to have the family that I do for sure. I have no kids. We have two fluffy golden retrievers, a almost 9-year-old and a brand new baby puppy. He's 4 months old, called Dennis. And yes, he is a menace. I started my career in accounting and finance. And then I thought, heck no, do I ever want to? Yes. So I went to school first for accounting and I thought, no, I don't want to be spend my career in some back office with my visor and my calculator. Thank you very much. So then I switched to HR and I thought, heck no, traditional HR, operational HR. I don't want to babysit adults for a living. Thank you very much. So then I settled on a entrepreneurship degree. So I have a business degree with the focus on entrepreneurship. And that was awesome because it taught me a little bit about a lot of things. And with my finance background, that helped a lot. And now it just allowed me to do and get involved in a whole bunch of super interesting things that really suits my conceptual personality. But I worked as in accounting and finance. My brain works like that. I didn't love it, but my brain really worked like that. Mm-hmm. But I started my first entrepreneurial business in 2009 while I was also working in corporate. And I don't know if there's any entrepreneurs out there, but it doesn't pay very well at the beginning. So I got into consulting at that same time.
What? No, it doesn't?
I'm 13 years in and it's still not paying very well. So I started consulting at the same time. So I was a partner in a online education company back in 2009 at the same time I was consulting. And then I started a wedding business randomly, had that for 8 years. Yeah. Had that for 8 years, sold it in 2010 and started my Expert in Hope business in 2018. And then I started my current the work that I do most passionately, which is called Paradigm Corporate Wellness, which is my workplace mental health business, in 2020. And here we are in 2022. I still do consulting, but mostly in the HR transformation, organizational design space. What do you call it? Turnover, helping people with turnover transformation. And in the mental health skills training area, that is my number one passion, is helping leaders and HR professionals figure out how to navigate mental health at work. I think it's a real gap in our education, in our professional development, in our management training. And I am working to close that gap.
So what does your current business do?
My current business does skills training, mental health skills training. So I do, I have a certificate program, 21 hours of instruction. And then I also have a program for leaders and their people to connect and to raise their mental health maturity, which is it's a digital subscription. I fundamentally believe that mental health is not one and done. Education around mental health has to be, gets to be constant. We get to continue having these conversations and it just gets to be how we work around here, how we speak in our organization. And so my Language of Mental Health program is a annual program, subscription-based, on purpose, so that we continue to reinforce these ideas and concepts.
For the audience, I want to differentiate the term, because just because you say mental doesn't mean mental health doesn't mean mental illness. And when we talk about health in general, so we talk about mental health, emotional health, and physical health. So why would anybody want to not be mentally healthy physically healthy and not mentally happy? Or physically healthy, not emotionally happy? I mean, I'm 51. I've been up and down. And now I don't feel a good direction. I feel safe. But is it, is my mental healthness solid? Not as solid as it used to be when I had less money in the bank account. So mental health has nothing to do with the amount of money you have in your bank account. Has that nothing to do with being ill or being bulimic or anorexic or anything like that. It's just, hey, healthy mind in a healthy body. So I think that's what a lot of people forget in the business world, is they tend to associate mental health with mental illness. So I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not there. Has nothing to do with that. Is it a safe environment for people to work? Period.
Yeah. And it is, the sort of old school thinking that mental health and mental illness are the same. What mental illness are diagnosable mental illnesses, like you mentioned, bulimia, anorexia, clinical depression, clinical anxiety, all of those things are mental illness. And mental health and mental illness are not mutually exclusive. So you can have a diagnosed mental illness and still feel mentally well, mentally healthy. And you can have a, you don't need a diagnosed mental illness to not feel mentally well, to not feel like yourself.
Correct.
And it is as important, if not more important, in my opinion, than your physical health, because actually your mental health will contribute even more to your physical health than the other way around, I believe.
When I talk about business in regards to behavioral-based leadership, is we follow a process called think, feel, do. Is that you think some way that triggers some type of emotion that's attached to past experiences, and those experiences are attached to chemical reaction, oxytocin, serotonin, anyways, and that drives an action, right? So when you think about it, if you start at the stem of everything, if you're mentally not healthy, then there's kind of bad emotions or, you know, toxic emotions. And when I say toxic, it is toxic. It's a chemical reaction that inhibits you to do certain activities. So if you're feeling down on yourself and you feel fat, because I'm talking for myself, sometimes I feel fat and therefore I get into a position where I eat my emotions. And instead of going to the gym or doing something healthy, then I will eat emotions. I say, oh, I'm okay. I'll eat pizza. Although, don't get me wrong, I think pizza is in small doses and everything. There's no in moderation. Everything is good for you. But sometimes I fall in a trap of, and then it gets into a vicious circle, right? So, I mean, that's the think, feel, do, is we apply behavioral-based leadership. How will you change the way that people think so that they think, so that they feel different, therefore act different?
Love it. I love that. The action part is really key for me as well.
Exactly, right? You can talk about it all day long, but if it doesn't translate in something, right? Hence what we're talking about, translating vision into frontline operations. If you can't, if your vision and your tactics and all, sorry, if your vision and strategies can't be tactical and tangible, then they're not worth the paper that are written on.
That is for certain.
So why do you think hope is a strategy?
Because hope is a strategy. So let me tell you a little bit about my journey with the science of hope. So back in 2017, I was not feeling mentally well. I was working too much. I was pulled in too many different directions, and we were dealing with mental health and addiction at home. And I remember very, very clearly this super innocuous moment where I recognized that I got my hope back, not recognizing that I'd lost it in the first place.
Oh, shit.
And we know that feeling, right? When we say that word hope, we know intuitively what that means, that bubbly, anticipatory kind of feeling. But in that moment, I realized that finally, I was zesting for the future again. I was looking forward to what was coming next. But then I remember slumping sort of down and thinking like, what the hell? Why didn't I not know that I had stopped doing that? Why? I mean, I was going through the motions. I was going to work. I was getting groceries. I was putting on pants. These were all things that were happening, but I had it was just status quo. My AAA personality had dulled down to a W personality. I don't know. That analogy doesn't work, but you know what I mean?
An like F just, strategy. I get you. I get you.
Like it was just status quo going through the motions. And my number one value in life is lifelong learning. And so I want to solve all the problems. And so I started to research and learn and ask and talk to people about what had gone on, how I got there. Mm-hmm. And that's when I found the science of positive psychology, which is a field of study founded by the American Psychology Association president back in the late 80s. Dr. Martin Seligman founded the science of positive psychology. And it is the antithesis to traditional psychology. So if you think of traditional psychology as the science of decreasing sadness, positive psychology is the science of increasing wellness. Instead of going from negative to neutral, we're going from neutral to flourishing. Oh. And a subfield of study within positive psychology is the science of hope. And I learned about this science and all of the evidence to support this science and all the scientists doing research in this space. And I felt so validated and so like the skepticism has gone away, had went away. And I thought, hope has a PR problem and I aim to solve it.
I'm really torn on the term positivity, because I believe that some people are, and I guess we're generalizing the term, because sometimes when it's dark outside, it's dark outside. You can wish it light all you want. It's so being extra bubbly, and I don't want to shoot down the word positivity because I truly believe in it. I truly, truly believe in it. I think objectivity is key as well. So again, I support you. I hear you. I believe you. Sometimes I feel that overly optimistic people in ignoring risk. And so, I think that that's what you're not saying that.
1,000,000,000% correct. So as you were speaking, I was going to say, do you mean that you don't agree with the word positivity, or do you, is it optimism that is the challenge? Because often that's what I hear. Because positivity just means above zero, right? Above neutral.
True. So
as opposed
true,
to negative.
Yes.
But yeah. optimism often gets confused as a synonym for hope.
Yes.
And I believe that they are two completely
agreed.
They are two related things. And here's what I believe the differences are between the two. So I believe that an optimistic person believes that it's just going to work out. Things are just going to happen for me. I don't really need to do anything about it.
Yeah.
It's just going to work out.
Yes.
But a hopeful person is going to take action towards that positive future, is going to take control over the things they can control, take action towards that hopeful future. So an optimistic person is going to wish to win the lottery, and a hopeful person is going to buy a ticket.
Ah.
It's that action piece that differentiates a hopeful person from an optimistic person in my mind. A hopeful person is typically optimistic, but you don't have to be hopeful to be optimistic.
Is so from the terminology realistic comes to mind. And I think that what you're saying, not I think, what I hear you're saying is that being optimistic doesn't make you realistic, where hopeful makes you realistic. Like, I hope that the effort that I put out will give you the result that I'm looking for. Does that make sense or no?
Yes. But I don't believe that every hopeful person is always realistic either, because you could be taking actions towards an unrealistic future.
Oh,
also.
True. Yes, very true. Yeah, that's a.
It's the
semantics
action,
are good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the action piece that differentiates hope from optimism for me. My definition of hope is that the future will be better than today by taking action over the things we can control.
Say that again. Can you say it slowly, please?
Yep. The future will be better than today by taking action over the things we can control. And where that definition comes from is the work of two scientists, two researchers that I model my work against. A gentleman by the name of Dr. Rick Snyder, C.R. Snyder, and the late Dr. Shane Lopez. And Dr. Snyder is a protege of Dr. Seligman, who founded positive psychology. And Dr. Snyder came up with hope theory, which is something that totally resonated with me. Hope theory is an equation: goals, which we all know and understand, right? Goals, plus agency thinking, which is our intrinsic motivation to work toward the goal, plus pathways thinking, which is our ability to overcome the obstacles that are absolutely going to get in the way, the obstacles and barriers that are absolutely going to get into the way. So goals plus agency thinking plus pathways is how my definition is based on that hope theory of getting towards that future state, that goal, using intrinsic motivation, taking control over the things we can control, and taking action towards that, using our critical thinking and pathways thinking, which is that obstacles and barriers mitigation part.
I love formulas. Mm-hmm. It just, for me, is so when I talk about prosperity, for example, I talk about profitability plus sustainability equals prosperity. How do you make profit in a way that is repeatable continuously so that you have a prosperous, meaning long, continuous, I don't want to say boring, but, you know, consistent, like, you know, we work Monday to Friday to have, to be able to spend time to regenerate, to be, have a sustainable lifestyle on Saturday and Sunday. I feel that a lot of rich people, like uber rich, that get uber rich quick, and I think of young actors, they have nothing to hope for anymore, right? Because demand creates some type of emotion. I wish I had that. Creates some type of work ethic, creates some types of something to look forward to, because you said the word goal. And I feel that when you're young and you can get whatever you want, whatever you want, you wish, you desire, what do you hope for? Like, there's nothing to hope for at the exception of world peace. And that is, for a young person, you know, kind of three levels up than they're capable of thinking, right?
I don't know if I agree with you. I think,
okay,
I think that hopeful people are at every stage of life, in every situation. If you have read Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, that he's an Auschwitz survivor.
Okay.
And he wrote a book that tells of his time during the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And he has so much hope in that story. I think of Will Smith. I don't know if you've read his autobiography, but he talks about his, you know, like you mentioned, kids who get rich really fast. He, mm-hmm. Love him or hate him, he got rich really fast. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, yeah. You know, skyrocketed him. And then he decided he wanted to be the biggest movie star in the world. So he went from DJ, Fresh Prince, and Jazzy Jeff to, you know, TV star to movie star to, you know, but he's had goals all the way along the way. To hear him tell it, he's had goals all the way along mm-hmm. the way. And money really had nothing to do with it, or fame didn't really have anything to do with it, except opportunity. Of course, I gave him more opportunity. And then I think of, you know, older generation people who are retired, or people who are in their 70s and 80s. And I had a conversation with a very close friend of mine who's going to be 70 this year. And she said to me, I have no goals. I'm like, what are you talking about? You have no goals. I know you've just retired. I know you have goals to spend more time with your grandkids. That totally counts. I know you have goals to get out and walk more after sitting at your desk for the last 50 years. You, like, at every age and stage of life and every socioeconomic situation, hope lives there.
No, don't get me wrong. I agree. Sometimes I feel that they can't find hope because they've lost goals, or they're struggling mm-hmm. to find their goals.
Yeah.
And that's what I meant is really when you have everything in the world, what do you hope for? Right. And so sometimes it's very difficult, because I'm kind of in that situation. I've reached a point in my life where, like, financially I'm stable, my life is stable, my life is good, you know, and then so what am I hoping for? And trying to pinpoint it to create hope is not as easy as it seems. It is not easy. You said something before about your definition, and I want to read. So this author, Kalidasa, was born 2,500 before Christ in something in India. The poem is called Salutation to the Dawn. And what I like about that one is we talk about hope, and it really, where the word hope is in this poem just is at the meat of everything. So hear me out. So look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In this brief course, lie in the verities and reality of your existence, for the bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Such is the salutation of the dawn. Isn't that beautiful?
So beautiful. And how cool that we've been using that language for gajillions of years.
I know, right? Mm-hmm. And when you read your definition, I was like, damn, that's the poem. And so you say, if you live your day every day well, then just being you, being what you believe in, recognizing your path creates a vision of hope. And I think that that's something that we're struggling in today's day when we live life so fast that sometimes we don't recognize the dawn. We don't recognize the time that we've got. And we're so far-fetched in achieving that I just love the word, how you use hope. Like it just brings sunshine in my head. When you think of hope, right? When you think about it, right? You use the word hope and everybody kind of perks up. You're like, well, you know, it's just, what are you hoping for, right? It just, I don't know. It just brings, to your point, positivity in, I'm going to tell you a secret. When I was in the corporate world, I used to fire people with ice cream.
Amazing.
You're giggling, right? Nobody ever doesn't like ice cream. And so I was the bearer of bad news with ice cream. And then you're like eating ice cream, having a walk. And then people go, hey, you know, it would just ease the tension of the bad news. And so since then, I've always tell my team, if ever I show up with ice cream, just run and just go away. But the reason why I say that and associate with hope is that I would, when it came time for somebody, I was like, hey, you know what? You were hoping that this was going to work out. It doesn't mean that it should kill your hope. You should look for hoping for something else. And I just kind of remembered that, what I used to say and how that word is so powerful used at the right time.
And that's where its power is. So often when we hear that word and don't think that deeply about it, it can be misconstrued, truly misconstrued as something fluffy, cosmic, woo-woo like. Mm-hmm. You know, hope is not a strategy. Well, it actually is, because a strategy indicates a plan, a mm-hmm. goal. And the hope part of that is figuring out why you're doing that strategy and then executing on it, taking that action over the things you can control to get you to that goal, to that executed strategy. Hope absolutely is a strategy because of the action piece of it.
It's so true. I'm going to change my language. I'm going to say, okay, hope is your strategy. Okay, how do we translate your strategy? Okay, how do we make your strategy something tangible so that your hope becomes a reality? Yeah, you know what? You've convinced me.
Hope without action is just a wish.
Yeah.
Wishing is not a strategy, but hope absolutely is a strategy.
There's a Japanese saying that says, vision without action is a dream. Action without vision is a nightmare. And I repeat that very, very frequently. And I say, let's do this. Okay, great. Where are we going with this? And, you know, the more I think about it, what are you hoping to achieve? I use that in my language as well. Now you've got me thinking about, when do I use hope? When do I use, because semantics dictate culture and dictate action and dictate emotions so much. What do you hope to achieve? So yeah, I'm putting a positive spin on the conversation. I'm manipulating the conversation to provide a positive outcome or to draw a positive outcome out of the individual.
Look and at that. To get them thinking about that future state.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why people do purchases as well. If I want to buy a new pair of hiking boots, I buy them for my future self. I want to hike better. I want to hike longer. I want to. Huh. Very well done. So how does hope fall into mental health? Mm. How do we use hope for mental health?
Yeah. So when we have that future vision, when we know or have aspirations towards that future vision, that keeps us going the next step, keeps us taking the next thing. Because once we have lost that zest for the future, we mm-hmm. think, well, what the hell? Why do we need to keep trying? Why do we need to keep putting on pants, you know? And so when I think having that hope for the future, that vision for what's possible, that vision for that better hiking day, whatever. I mean, it can mm-hmm. be as simple as that, or it can be something grandiose that you're working on. But once you have that vision for the future, it's the progress along the path to that goal that's actually more important than the vision itself.
I agree.
Because if you have that vision and you know where you're going, you figure out where you are, and then you take those baby steps to get you there. Every little successful baby step you take builds your confidence, builds that foundation to know that you can take that next step, can take mm-hmm. that next step. And pretty soon you're looking back going, crap, look how far I've come. I may have still far to go, but look at how far I've come. And then your confidence continues to boost.
I always say, often at times in business, we put a goal, but the goal is nothing compared to the journey, because what you learn from the journey is more useful than the actual goal. And we tend to overestimate what we can achieve over a short period and underestimate what we can achieve in a longer period. And I don't know where I got that, but I forget.
Well, but anyways. Sometimes the bigger the goal and the further in the distance it is, it actually becomes scientifically less motivating because it feels overwhelming. It feels super impossible. And so when you like have those, work towards those, but focus on the projects and or the progress and the milestones to get you closer to that thing, that is what's actually going to keep the motivation going, because it's getting you closer. So the vision becomes clearer. So the time between now and then becomes shorter and all of that. And the vision is murky on purpose, because as you progress towards it, it's likely going to change in some way.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And I think we forget about that as well. And a hopeful person recognizes that and actually uses it to their advantage, because as they are actioning and overcoming the barriers, they're recognizing and reevaluating what's possible and how the goal might need to change. And that's definitely a trait of a hopeful person as well.
I tend to apply, because of what we do, right? We're operators by trade and we help companies build and scale and all that stuff. And I still use a very military approach to situation, mission, execution, support, logistics, command, control. And in the mission is often breaking down into objectives. And then you go, okay, what's the first to get to the mission, to realize the mission, you need to achieve the shorter objectives that compound in a larger mission. So that's something that, in the business world, you can call them goals. I know that the EOS system calls them rocks, whatever you want to choose. But none of those, I think the one thing that Lindsay said that I really like is baby steps. And so some other people say, you know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, you masochistic people that kill an elephant one bite at a time. That's awful. I think the hard part that I'm struggling with in creating hope is, what do I do today? What do I do today that gets me closer to my goal or objective or what I hope to achieve? And sometimes that is very, very difficult. And the word that I put in my brain continuously is consistency. So I don't try to reward myself. I say, hey, listen, you did it yesterday. Stay consistent. Do it today. You did it yesterday. Stay consistent. Do it today. And that for me has been a payoff in regards to going to bed early, waking up with no alarm at the same time. Pretty darn, your body is pretty accurate. It amazes me how I always wake up. Before, I used to wake up at 4:30 in the morning. I used to force myself, I need to shove more stuff in my day. And then I came to realize through my COO, he's like, Martin, fitness is part of your job right now as our boss. I was like, okay, doesn't make sense to me, but sure, I'll bite into it. And now it's like I go to bed at 10:04 and I wake up at 6:24 all the time without an alarm. It amazes me. It's amazing how, you know, focusing on consistency, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of makes you more hopeful, like fills your hope bucket. I don't know how else to say it.
Habit and routine is my secret sauce. It absolutely is my secret sauce. Motivation and self-control only get you so far.
Yes.
Having a habit ingrained in your brain and the routine, which is a collection of habits ingrained in your brain, our brains are designed to be efficient. And so if we can move some of the things that we do into habits, that puts them into our subconscious. So we just do them without thinking about it, which saves us 8 calories per decision. So if we can put those things into our subconscious and really focus, use our energy to focus on the decisions that actually matter, the stuff Correct. That isn't habitual yet, or we can't create into routine. That's how we have higher productivity. That's how we're more efficient in our day. That's how we have brain power left over at the end of the day for our families and our kids. Habits and routines is absolutely the secret sauce.
I thought that I was pretty much let me rephrase that. I thought that I was king shit when it came down to routines and habits. I really thought so. I'm like, I've done behavioral based. I've done interrogation. I've done INT-OP. I know a lot about human behaviors. James Clear about Atomic Habits. I was like, oh, I'm not king shit on this. There's always somebody better, stronger. And James Clear does such a good job of creating a framework to be successful at creating habits. That 1% change. I mean, I'm all about continuous improvement. I worked and lived in Japan. I know all about fixing the trade, but he took it to the next level. He is very good at saying, okay, how do you build efficiency? And there's two things that in there that I absolutely love is creating the right environment. You can try, I'll use the word try, I hate trying, but you're doing, but you're not succeeding. You're not succeeding. And you're like, okay. And then you change the environment and all of a sudden you're successful. And all of a sudden you stack habits and now you're even more successful. Have you read the book?
Oh yes. Have I ever?
And your impressions, which one was what really got you out of James' book?
Yeah, the Habit Loop was the game changer for me. So the Habit Loop, for those who haven't read his book, is the idea that every habit starts with a cue and a response and a reward. There's 4 of them. Yeah. I can't remember what the 4th one is. Oh, yeah. So for me, I'm also an early riser. Mm-hmm. But feet to floor is unbelievably hard for me. Un-freaking-believably hard. And so because when my alarm goes off, there's the cue. Mm-hmm. My brain goes, sweet, time for a snooze. The action is I hit the snooze button. The reward is 9 more minutes of sleep. Mm-hmm. Change the cue. So I changed the alarm, like literally changed the sound on my phone because my brain wasn't used to that sound.
Yeah.
And so once I changed it, I heard the cue and my brain goes, I don't know what's happening here. I have to think about it. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, you're not thinking so clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the action is, okay, get up.
Yeah.
And now that sound floor. That I hear is my brain is now into the habit and routine. When I hear that sound, I know it's feet to floor.
I use the same thing for my phone. I used to be, first thing I would do is wake up in the morning, grab my phone, go to the washroom, you know, do things. And then I was attached to my phone looking at emails. Now I purposefully have put my phone downstairs in the charger. So I have to actually go closer to the garage, which is nowhere close to. And now I do my own thing. I do my stretching. It was so ingrained in my head that I had to take care of myself first. And I had to do my workout first thing in the morning. And I it was against the grain. What you did for 20 years in your life doesn't necessarily mean that it's applicable now because the environment has changed, the times have changed. Now I put, because all of my work is done East Coast time, and I live on the West Coast, now I work out at 3. There's nobody from the East Coast. Everybody's done by 3 p.m. our time. So my day starts earlier but finishes at 3, and now my kids are at school and they see me work out, so they want to work out with me too. So I'm helping them create. So I think I agree with you. For me, the environment and the stacking was the key thing, because if you eliminate the trigger, or like you said, the
cue. The change cue, the cue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, change the cue. I think it's a great... how does... The one thing that you said before, can you tell us your definition of hope again? Because there was a word in there that I really wanted to attach myself to.
Yeah. The future will be better than today by taking action over the things we can control.
That is it. You know, what's that AA is? The AA prayer is give me the... The ability
God
to
grant
choose.
Me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Yeah, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yes, and I think that's what I wanted to come back to. When you're hopeful, I think you the biggest decision that you have to make is what I can't and cannot do, mm-hmm. what can and cannot control, instead of being positive. Because one of the clients that I had way back when, he would say to me, don't put it out in the universe. Don't think about that. If you don't think about it, it's not going to happen. I'm like, what? Like, yeah.
That does sound like cosmic woo-woo.
Exactly, right? And he's like, but if you don't think about it, it's not going to happen. I said, yeah. Like, what do you want mean? You like, you don't want to pay these people? Yeah. If they don't ask for it, if I don't think about it, they'll forget it. I was like, where are you getting all of this, right? And he thought that by just being hopeful, it would control the outcome, which is not what you're saying.
Ew.
You're not exactly right. So I think a lot of people will were confusing when you think about hopeful. It's like, oh yeah, if I don't do nothing, I hope it's gonna. I hope. Well, there's nothing to hope, because what you're doing is you're
wishing.
You're not setting yourself up for success by understanding what you can and you can't control.
Well,
I'm sorry. I'm talking in circles here, but you get where I'm going.
But if you're just wishing that it's going to work out and not doing anything to get you to that place, you are just wishing. Hope without action is just a wish.
That's what I wanted to get back to, is that if you're not taking action, then it's just a wish. You're not being hopeful.
Well, and also to comment on the control piece, because let's think about COVID, right? The last 3 years, people were very hopeless because they really felt like there was nothing within their control. Of course, you can't control the pandemic, but you can control your response to it. You can control how you focused on your kids. You can control how you continue to move your body, mm-hmm. how you made choices around your food intake and your drink intake and connecting with your people. And you had tons of things within your control while the greater world felt outside of control. And that is where the hope comes back in, is when you do feel like you have a sense of control over something, hope comes back. When the overwhelm and feeling of being out of control, that's where hopelessness can set in.
It amazes me how even I, after a longer period, I consider myself very disciplined. I was in the military. I still use that discipline. I'm very meticulous about how I spend my time and how I use process to achieve certain things. Even at the end, at the early kind of 2020, we're a year in, kind of 18 months in, I was feeling it. I was feeling it, and I'm disciplined. And I was like, okay, let's go out for a walk. Let's do this. You know, let's change. Monday nights, we're going to have Vietnamese. Tuesdays, we're going to have tacos. Like, let's put some change in our life that doesn't feel like we're just repeating. We're just not having that Groundhog Day. But yet, at a certain point, I was starting to feel hopeless. So when you think, when you said Auschwitz, imagine how strong your hope must have been, how strong somebody's desire to be hopeful when you're not living on anything, people are dying around you. Like this little pandemic was nothing compared to, and sorry, I'm not saying that our trauma wasn't as good, as big as their trauma, but I'm saying that was a shit show. Somebody, you know, people were dying of, anyways, sorry.
So two things there. The exhaustion that we all have felt at various times over the last 2 years is real and relevant, and we get to experience it. We get to feel it. Mm-hmm. Hell, I'm an expert in hope, and I felt the exact same way as everybody else at various times in the last 2 years, you know? And we get to sit in that, and we get to move through it. In fact, we can't build resilience unless we go through these things.
Agreed. Yes.
It's how we continue to show up. It's how we continue to honor ourselves and take care of ourselves and recognize those feelings and name them and be in them and communicate them. That is the part that matters. It's that journey. It's that progress along the mm-hmm. path. Somebody's always going to have it worse than you, and somebody's always going to have it better than you.
Yes.
But if it matters to you, it matters. Full stop. End of story. If it matters to you, it matters. And mm-hmm. you get to feel that. You get to experience that. You get to get through that, to go through that. And nobody gets to judge you or tell you that somebody else has it worse and you should pull up your big girl panties and move on. If it matters to you, it matters, and you get to go through that.
So true. I struggle with that. So the organization that I help, which I won't name here, there is a young lady that I met. And so for those who know Vancouver, downtown East Side is like Skid Row in LA. So it's very lots of drugs. Lots of prostitution, lots and lots. So I provide assistance to the leadership team for an organization that helps bring dignity back to people on the downtown East Side, or trying to get out of, you know, they're doing everything that they can to get out of that vicious circle of addiction or stuff. And this young lady, no more than 21, and like, okay, so why are you here? So just tell me your story. And she's like, yeah, I used to get raped by my uncles all the time. And she says, I came down here and I kept getting raped again and again. And then it's not until I broke the circle. And I'm sitting there just crying, and she's consoling me. She's consoling me. And I was like, no, my problems are nothing. Nothing compared to what you have lived. But to your point, why was I emotional? I didn't live through that. But her experience caused some trauma that I had to go through and share with her, because I have a problem with that. I have a problem with little T and big T. And I was like, I'm always kind of going, Martin, your problems are so small compared to what other people are going. Suck it up, buttercup. Keep moving. But that's how I was raised, right? So it's very hard for me to kind of drop that PTSD when I was in the military. It wasn't something that we dealt with. It was like, okay, keep going. All right. No, drink more. You'll be fine. And so, and you're right. Even I, middle-aged man going through this, and she was consoling me. That's something that just, I will always keep with me in regards to big T, little T. Mm-hmm.
And it matters.
What is the book on your nightstand by your side, or the movie? What piece of reference material do you keep by your side and have kept by your side for the longest time?
Two of my, so I read a lot, like a lot.
a lot.
Like a lot, like 75 bucks a year. So two top five influential books in my life over the last 5 years, call it. Number one is called The Book of Joy.
Cool.
And if you listen to it in the audio version, it is so good. So it is the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu on the occasion of the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. And they spend 5 days in dialogue talking about joy and hope and the future of humanity and spirituality. And they laugh a lot. I mean, these are two incredibly wisdom-filled humans that have seen a ton in their respective countries. Correct. And it is, I have the audio version and the book version, and I buy the book version for all the people because it is so it is so impactful. It is so amazing. And the audio version is great because the Desmond Tutu does his own talk part and the Dalai Lama's translator does his part. Like, it's so freaking cool. Yeah, it's so good. So the Book of Joy, for sure. And then the second one is The 5 a.m. Club by Robin Sharma.
I don't know that one.
Love him or hate him, Robin Sharma is a reasonably controversial author. One of his first books was The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. He's written a ton of books, and he's a guru for sure. And I picked up his book because of my problem of feet to floor. I wanted to get up early. I wanted to know, you know, the book talks about the science of getting up early and why it's good for you and all that good stuff. And for sure, I learned a ton of things about that. But this book, it's quite thick. This book, I don't know any other way to describe it. It was magical. It was inspirational. It was educational. It's written as a business fable, but it's quite thick for a traditional business fable. Mm-hmm. It is hopeful, and it is just so good. You just need to read it.
Done deal.
Both of those were and continue to be super impactful.
Thank you very much. I have got about 30 more questions. What is the one thing, if somebody is struggling at finding hope, can you give us a one sentence, two sentence kind of motivational, stick to it kind of speech? If somebody's struggling at finding hope, what would you offer?
Hope is contagious. So if you are not feeling hopeful, go and find the most hopeful person you know and spend some time with them. Because one day you are going to feel hopeful and somebody is going to need you and they can borrow from you. But in the meantime, go borrow from somebody else.
That is beautiful. That is absolutely beautiful. Pay them back later. Like, don't be afraid to go ask.
Oh, pay someone else back later, but go and find the most hopeful person you know.
Lindsay, so thank you so very much. You know what? The more I look away, the more I look in. My kids are so hopeful all the time. Who's the most glorious? Who's more joyful, as Sad Guru would say? The grumpy old person who's worrying about everything all the time, or the 10-year-old kid who's hopeful and just wants to be outside?
You know, it's neat. I have two podcasts, and one of them is called Hope Motivates Action. And we talk all about hope, hopeful things, and not so hopeful things. But there's a question I ask at the end of every show, and that is, guest, what gives you hope? And the hands down, out of my 130 plus episodes of that show, hands down, the most popular answer is our youth, our kids. Whether it's theirs, the kids they work with, the youth that they work with, the youth and kids are number one answer to what gives you hope.
I will attach that to me. I know. You have given us so much to work with, to think about, that for me, don't look too far, Martin. You don't have to put yourself out there. You don't have to look too far for what is hopefulness. Because like I said, I'm struggling through that right now. And thank you, Lindsay. It's been very, very helpful for me. It's been a good therapy session for me, actually.
It is my pleasure. Goodness knows, when you said to me, what do you want to talk about? Goodness knows I can talk about this particular topic for hours and hours and days. Amen. I'm very, very passionate about it. It has been hugely an influencing force in my life. And like I say, I hope has a PR problem, and everybody needs to know about it.
we will share. We will pass the message on. Everybody listening, make sure you pass on. When you listen to this episode, pass it on to everybody. Gift it. Give some hope to somebody else. Deal?
Fantastic.
Lindsay, website, contact you.
Yeah. So my hope website is expertinhope.com. And my workplace mental health website is Paradigm, PARADIGMCW.com.
And you will find all of Lindsay's contact details below in the page and on the website as well. So fill your boots. You'll have plenty of her information, and any video or anything else that Lindsay wants to share will be on there as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. I got a lot out of this one. It's very good.
Awesome. Me too.
With that being said, it is Friday. We are recording this on a Friday afternoon. It is beverage time. So I will tell you that my name is Martin Hunter. I am the host of the show. Please like, subscribe, and click notification bell, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to What CEOs Talk About. Make sure to click subscribe to get notified about future episodes, or check us out at www.whatceostalkabout.com.